From Liguori Publications, this is a Redemptorist Pastoral Communications audio cassette. Liguori's best-selling author, Philip St. Romain, with imprimaturs on 8 of his books, recently gave a workshop on Kundalini energy and Christian growth, East meets West on the Christian journey. At the workshop at the Maria Center in St. Louis, here's Philip St. Romain.
Good morning.
I'll pull this closer so you can hear better.
Okay. Good to see you all here. Didn't know there was so much interest in Kundalini energy. How many of you already have some idea of what this is we're talking about today? And so how many of you are here just to learn, maybe for the first time, what this is all about? Okay. Well, I find myself in a kind of a funny position talking about this. If anybody had told me 10 years ago that I would be doing this, I would have told them they were crazy. Because if you look through my book titles, and in particular at some of my publishers, you'll see that I'm pretty middle-of-the-road Catholic. I'd like to know how many Catholic writers have 8 books with imprimaturs on them these days. For example, my best-selling book is Catholic Answers to Fundamentalist Questions, which is an attempt to really say that Catholic tradition has something very unique and important to say that fundamentalists don't understand, and so to really stand up for the tradition. And because I think, as a Roman Catholic, the kind of growth that we are called to by Christ is a very holistic kind of growth, a growth that affirms the whole person. And so here I am now talking about Kundalini energy, which is in some circles considered a New Age topic, and therefore immediately incompatible in some way with the Catholic faith. How did I get here? Well, not by following a line of academic or intellectual interest, that's for sure. The only reason I'm here talking about Kundalini energy and Christian spirituality is because my journey in prayer and growth has led me to this place. The academic investigations, some of which I'll share with you today, came much later. So it's difficult for me to talk about this whole Kundalini experience and transformative process outside of the context of my journey I cannot talk about it as in a purely academic or theoretical sense, since I never knew about it in that way. It would be like for me trying to talk about the Holy Spirit as a purely academic theological topic. How does one talk about love as a purely academic theological topic, right? And so it is for Kundalini. Before I get too much into my presentation, I want to say a little bit about how this day might work. We're here from 9 to 4, and this day has been advertised as a workshop day. Now, a workshop to me means primarily an educational experience as contrasted with a retreat-type experience. Our topic especially does not lend itself very well to a retreat experience. We're not going to be trying to awaken the Kundalini today, for example. That is not one of our goals. It's, as you'll see from my presentation, it's not something that should happen to anybody until they're ready for it. To try to force that prematurely would be perhaps to do great harm to a person. So I'll be teaching today, and I'll build some process kind of experiences in, some little short meditations perhaps, some brainstorms, some question answer periods. But this is not a topic that lends itself very well either to small group discussion. So we'll have some interactive dynamics which will keep your energy going and mine as well. And we'll have some breaks. For example, this morning we go from 9 to 12. We can have one or two breaks in there. In the afternoon we can start up again at 1:30 or so and have a couple of breaks in the afternoon. And how does that sound to you for a plan of action for today? If before the breaks you need to get up and go somewhere or walk around, well, just feel free to do so. I hope my recovery from codependency has progressed sufficiently that I don't take that personally. You do what you need to do there, okay? Now into the material. I have been interested in the mystical traditions of all the world's religions, really, since my own adult faith conversion, which is around 1972 or 3. I grew up a Catholic. I went to Catholic schools. I grew up in a culture that was, you might even say, a Catholic culture, which is a South Louisiana Catholic, French, and Cajun kind of culture, where everybody's Catholic and everybody goes to Mass on First Friday. And even in the public schools where I grew up, on First Fridays the children were let out of school and they marched on over to the church and went to Mass and received communion. They allowed that to happen. So I was a cradle Catholic and a cultural Catholic, and I think that's very important in my own journey, that somehow that mythical, symbolic dimension of our faith took root in my childhood and has always been there for me in one sense whenever I needed it. But I drifted away from it to some extent during college. I was a biology major, and the academic milieu in biology is largely agnostic, if not atheistic, and so I learned all kinds of things about the theory of evolution and how the human body works, human physiology, ecology, and so forth. And although I never stopped going to Mass, I had really not grown much in my faith since childhood. Then I went on a Crucio retreat in 1973, and my faith started to wake up again. In fact, it woke wide awake with that retreat. And I followed that up with some time in charismatic renewal, Bible studies, Catholic inquiry classes, reading books, and just feeding myself in whatever way I could. I remember going to a Catholic bookstore the diocese had and asking them for some material to read on the Bible. The woman recommended to me a book by Raymond Brown called The Virginal Conception and the Bodily Resurrection of Jesus. That's the kind of material I started reading, not easy reading, but exactly the kind of reading I needed at that time. Very early into my adult faith journey, I began to pray contemplatively, not knowing a thing about contemplative prayer. Knowing that there were contemplatives in the church, but whenever I would read about that, would read that this was something that happened to very few people. More than likely, they were members of religious communities, and then even there, quite rarely so, unless they were a Carmelite or a Trappist or something like that. And so I would go to church, for example, at the end of the day, and I would pray the rosary. That's what I knew how to do. And it was good for me to do that. And then I would be ready to get up to leave, to go somewhere else. And I would just feel like sitting there, not feel like getting up. I would just feel like staying. Some kind of a tug to just, don't go anywhere, just stay. Well, what am I going to do? Well, you don't have to do anything. I don't have anything to read. Well, that's all right, just stay. And it wasn't like a voice that was talking, it was an urging. And sometimes I would sit for an hour, and sometimes I would sit for 2 hours, and then sometimes I would find myself being awoken in the middle of the night to just sit and be with what was definitely for me a, a sense of God's presence. It was not a Zen-type sitting where I was moving, you know, into a silence that I was trying to create for myself through posture and counting and things like that. It was a silence that more or less descended on me and grabbed me. And the charismatic experience, especially the glossolalia or gift of tongues, seemed to really move me quickly into that. And so I would give consent to this. Within a couple of years, I found myself, you might say, needing to take quiet time every day, or else I was a mess. Somehow, during those early years of faith, the sitting and the being with God in silence had progressed to the point where my whole system needed this kind of silence, or else I was not at peace with myself. Even up to about 1975 or 1976, I had no regular discipline of prayer. I would take quiet time here and there. I would give consent when the deep silence would descend on me. But prayer was a hit and miss thing. And finally, in about 1976 or so, 75, 76, I began to have a regular daily prayer time. And within a short period of time, I discovered that I could not function without that. Right, that's the backdrop. Something had happened to me early on that, all the way down to the level of physiology, not just my emotions, not just my spiritual being, but physiologically, I was not right with myself if I did not have my quiet period of relaxing and resting in God. I remember quite clearly going on a... The world, by the way, takes no consideration for such people and their needs. I remember even a member of a campus ministry team going on some of our planning trips away. And it was get up and get going and make breakfast and then have some kind of a verbal prayer together. And I needed to sit at least half an hour or 45 minutes doing nothing just to begin to feel myself, okay? And not being able to get that. And after 2 or 3 days, I was nauseated the whole time. Nauseated. Something right here around the navel, now I know what that's called. Something had kind of shriveled up and died, or dried up almost, without that deep silence. And I would be in the meeting a while, and I would rush out during the break just to sit outside, but it was never long enough. It was only about 10 minutes. And for me, three widespread 10-minute breaks are not the same as one 30-minute. Doesn't have the same effect at all. And these were my very good friends, and they would say, "What is the matter with you? Did you eat something that disturbed you? What's wrong?" And I'd say, "I just need to be quiet. I just need to be by myself and pray a while." But that was always getting disturbed. Well, it became quite a challenge when I got married. My wife had to know this was going to be a regular part of my day, and she's been very good about that. And so it has been. As I say, since those early beginnings, I discovered I had been touched, you might say, by a contemplative grace, called to a contemplative kind of spirituality that I never sought. It came very naturally to me. That probably has a great deal to do with one's temperament type, I believe. That is part of the picture. Mine is of a very strong, introverted, intuitive type. In Jung's typology. And that is the type that is most inclined toward this particular kind of prayer. Most easily drawn to it, you might say. So from 1976 on, with a daily discipline of a half hour to 45 minutes of prayer, this experience has grown and deepened to where in the mid-80s, and certainly by the late 80s, I was experiencing what we're now calling the awakening of the Kundalini. Well, I think it was already awakened, really, in the mid-70s with those early contemplative experiences. But by the mid-80s, and late 80s, it was beginning to work in the higher centers that we're going to talk about today, the higher chakras, and was creating all kinds of havoc as it was doing so. Prior to the mid 80s, it was working in the lower centers, cleansing them and renewing them and really opening the heart so that a kind of a contact with God at the level of the heart was possible for me. But it was not working in the higher centers as much. It was from time to time, but not as much. So that by the mid to late 80s, I would find myself having all kinds of strange experiences in prayer, of lights, inner lights, beautiful experiences of purple lights and gold lights and circular patterns and swirling patterns that were so captivating that I could just observe them and pass the time observing them. And it was a kind of a spiritual experience. It was not merely an interesting phenomenon. It was something that seemed to have a relationship to God. There was a sense of energy trying to move in certain parts of the brain and then getting blocked and of a great pain in that area. Then if it giving way and something in the body relaxing, all kinds of crazy things like that. If you want to get into the gory details, read the book. It explains a lot of that, of something happening in the middle of the forehead, a new way of seeing beginning to happen. A seeing that is a very beautiful experience that I'll describe as we go along, and things happening on the top of the head and above the head. And so I knew there was a connection between these experiences and my prayer, but I wasn't sure what they were. And I was by that time very, very familiar with the Catholic mystical literature and knew I had never read anything about that in the Catholic mystical literature. Our mystical literature seems much more concerned with what's happening on a faith level between the person and God. And rightly so. That's really where it's at with mysticism. Yet what was the meaning of all these other experiences? I talked to spiritual directors about that. Said, you know, I understand that, you know, this is maybe not of the essence of the relationship with God, but something is happening to me, and it does have some relationship to my prayer. And it is awakening a different kind of an experience of God that's more non-dual. It's a very different. Can you help me with that? Well, they would always say, just keep going and let's watch and see what happens. And it seems to have good fruit, so it must be of the Holy Spirit. You know, if you're a spiritual director, that's how we talk, you know. They weren't always familiar with, well, most of them were not very familiar with the Eastern traditions, except perhaps for Zen. And you can't always find much about this in the Zen traditions either. Well, I continued to read, and as I say, I had always been interested in the mystical traditions of other world religions, and was teaching a class on prayer and meditation. And one of my students brought me a book by Ram Dass. I had heard of Ram Dass and had not especially been drawn to read him. I knew him in connection with his work with Timothy Leary in trying to get people to turn on to the mystical life through drugs. And as a substance abuse counselor, I was not impressed with that approach to the divine. And still have great skepticism about that. I'll talk about that in a little while. But Ram Dass apparently moved far beyond that in his growth. That was a beginning for him, but his own journey took him to the East and to a real authentic Hindu guru and to a kind of a growth that has borne very much good fruit. If you followed his life, you know that he's very interested in relieving the pangs of hunger in third world countries and now working to heal the broken relationships between people in the inner city. He's a, I think, quite authentic spiritual person. And in his book, The Only Dance There Is, which was quite fun reading, It's not for beginners, I would say, but it's a series of lectures that he gave to the Menninger Foundation back in the early 70s. I thoroughly enjoyed reading him. He's got a tremendous sense of humor, and he's a great storyteller. And during the course of those lectures, he talked at some length about the chakras and Kundalini energy. And when he talked about the centers and their location, how we experience them in the physical body, I said, that corresponds exactly to my experiences, where things are happening. He didn't get much into Kundalini, but I could already tell that this was the kind of literature that I needed to consult to maybe learn more about these experiences and their meaning. I had no expectation of this particular kind of writing clarifying my faith relationship to the divine all that much. That was something that I think in my Catholic spiritual direction I could get all the help I needed about what's happening between God and I. That's the focus. But what was happening to me, the person, I was also quite interested in. And I that's what I thought I could learn. And so I began to consult libraries and book catalogs for some literature that might help me. And to make a long story short, eventually came upon a whole wealth of literature concerning the yogic and especially the yogic idea of multiple bodies and chakras and Kundalini energy, and came to some understanding of what that's all about and how we can relate that to our own growth as people. And I'm going to try to cover in very general terms some of what I've learned about that. This is a topic that is potentially quite complex. You do great injustice to this kind of topic by giving a very superficial treatment of it, because it's almost more dangerous that people have a superficial and general understanding of it than that they have no understanding at all. And so I run the risk in a one-day workshop of doing that, but I hope there can be enough substance in it that it at least leaves you with the awareness that we certainly haven't said everything that is to be said today about this topic. Okay. Now, that's a little bit about how I came into this this area. And so as you can see, I did not ever practice Kundalini yoga. I do have a guru. His name is Jesus Christ. And a teacher is the Catholic Church. So I have everything I need there. In the Eastern traditions, you are advised to have a yogi or a teacher of some kind to lead you through this process. And since I was already well into it before I even knew about that, well, I figured my teacher was leading me into that. And so I wasn't a practitioner of Kundalini yoga. I wasn't a dabbler in the occult. I know that this topic is frequently a topic that is found in the section of the library called occult literature, or if you go to a bookstore, it will be in the section of the bookstore called New Age / occult. In a way, that's kind of unfortunate. The word occult means hidden, and the reason this particular kind of information was hidden was because in the wrong hands, it can be very destructive. And that's why there was always some secrecy. Even in the Eastern traditions, where they know a great deal about this, there's a great deal of secrecy about Kundalini. The writings about it were always veiled in a highly symbolic and mythical kind of a language. You were always advised to be in a relationship with a guru or a yogi or someone who had the experience themselves and who could see exactly where you were coming from and who would not invite you to awaken this energy until you were ready for it, because if it were awakened prematurely, it could do a great amount of damage. And so that's how it has earned the label occult. I would make a big distinction between this kind of literature and other kinds of literature which are more prone toward magic or astrology or witchcraft or things like that. They're sometimes also called a cult. And there's a hidden, mysterious kind of a tradition there as well, and that's why it earns the label of cult. Okay? Nevertheless, when you use a word like kundalini, there are some people who will judge what you're doing simply because you're using that word without even hearing what you have to say about it. And that has already happened to me because of my book and other workshops I've done on this. Somehow, this previously Orthodox Catholic has drifted into New Age circles and is now teaching other Catholics about the occult. The reason I use the word kundalini is because there's nothing in our tradition that corresponds to that. If there were, I would use it. But there is not. The Hindus and the yogis have identified this process. They have named it and they have described it thoroughly. It is also known by all of our mystics, and many whom even we would say are not especially mystical types have experienced this. But their eyes were somewhere else. Their eyes were more on the faith relationship between the person and the divine. And these other things that were happening were, well, they were there. And they knew they were part of the transformative process. But I don't think they were well understood. And even when our tradition does describe the transformative process, it does so usually more on the psychological level rather than the psychophysiological level. So St. Teresa's and St. John's and others, when they're writing about dark nights and transformative transition periods, are talking more about a psycho-spiritual transformation rather than what's happening on a holistic process that incorporates the physical. Okay. So you see why, for me, there is a personal context to this out of which the academic has come. Now, what is kundalini energy? Well, I don't know. That's the answer. I know that it does exist. And I do make some distinction between this energy and the Holy Spirit, although I think that they work in concert when the transformative process is a faith-oriented process. All that we can do is say some things about this energy, but to say I don't know what kundalini is to sit in the same kind of humility with which we have to sit regarding all kinds of other energies. What, for example, is a feeling? Does anybody know? Even though you have them all day long. What is it? What is a thought? Does anybody know what a thought is? Well, if we don't even know what a thought or a feeling is, well, then it's okay to not know what kundalini energy is too, right? I really like the quote by Lillian Silburn here. It's not an easy reading book. Toward the middle of that paragraph, she says, although she may be experienced with great intensity and bring about remarkable effects, kundalini cannot be grasped nor described by the intellect. That's so true. Whole volumes on the subject fail to convey the slightest idea of what she really is, and yet, to those who experience her, she is as simple as life. Better still, she is the very source of all life, but how to define life? You can't quite do it, right? As St. Augustine said, when someone asked him, what is time? He says, when you don't ask me, I know, but when you ask me, I don't know. You'll see that the Hindus have a tendency to regard kundalini as the same thing as the Christian experience of the Holy Spirit. Perhaps the great guru of kundalini in the West was Swami Muktananda, who was brought to the West by Ram Dass and has set up an ashram. He's since died. So the first paragraph from his book, Kundalini, The Secret of Life, where he says, almost every tradition speaks of Kundalini in one form or another and describes Kundalini in its own way. In Japanese, it is called Ki. In Chinese, Qi. The scriptures of Christianity call it the Holy Spirit. What is that Kundalini? It is the power of the self, the power of consciousness. Well, you might want to disagree with him about Christians and Kundalini being the Holy Spirit, as we'll see as we go along. I, in my own experience, make a distinction between the two. Nevertheless, the statement that it is the power of the self with the capital S, the deep self or true self, and the energy of consciousness, I think is a very accurate description of what this is in my own experience. The energy of consciousness. Whenever Kundalini is talked about in the East, it is always in relation to consciousness. Okay? Then there's this big long quote from Gopi Krishna in his article, The Awakening of Kundalini. Gopi Krishna is also a key figure in bringing the awareness of Kundalini to the West. His book, Kundalini, The Evolutionary Energy in Man, was a book that described his own experience of the awakening of this energy in his own life somewhere in the 1930s after years of meditation, and all the changes that that brought to his life as a result of that. Look at the last paragraph in his quote. My own humble contribution to the ancient tradition of Kundalini, not as a speculative hypothesis, but as the direct outcome of my own experience, is that this dormant reservoir of bioenergy is not only responsible for mystical experience and the still baffling PSI phenomenon, but is also the presently unlocated and still disputed evolutionary mechanism in human beings, as well as the fountainhead of genius and extraordinary talent. Gopi Krishna received a great deal of attention for the way that he explained Kundalini as an energy that in some way united the biological sciences, the psychological sciences, and mystical experience as an energy that is common to all of these. And again, I think he's correct. That is true. This is an energy that is that deep and that basic and that primary. Then you can look at that last insight from classical philosophy and meditate on that for years and maybe get something out of that relationship between energia and entelechia. The main reason I put that one in is because Kundalini energy is not just simply an energy that awakens. It is an intellectual energy. It's an energy, in other words, that is going to do something. It is going to produce some changes. The word entelechy refers to a developmental potentiality. So you'd say that it's entelechy for the acorn to become an oak tree. And already in the acorn, the oak tree in some way exists. There is an energy and an intelligence already there within the acorn that will, through time and the proper nourishment of the soil and the air and the sunlight, bring this little acorn to become an oak tree. And Kundalini is an energy like that. It will take these human acorns and turn them into something else, whether they like it or not, you might add, once this thing is awakened. If you don't like it, you'll just hurt yourself. But you will go kicking and screaming into some kind of a development. If you're inclined toward Jung's psychology, you could view this energy as an archetypal energy, an archetype that is perhaps not described in the Jungian literature, although I think late in his life he was studying this phenomenon and was inclined to see Kundalini as the energy of the soul or self archetype. Most archetypal energies, if you're familiar with Jung, lead us along a certain line of development. The hero, the hunter, and so forth. There are more and more books coming out on these archetypes, especially trying to relate them to midlife transitions. And Kundalini is, you might say, the base archetype, the mother of all the archetypes, which after slugging your way through the others and learning what you can about yourself from the others, finally you come upon this one and its energy, and then awakens the true self. Now, we'll come back to what is Kundalini, but we have to take a long, circuitous route before we do so. For now, you know, we've only said we don't know what it is, but we know some things about it, which is true for everything else that we know, right? And so we can say that this is a very powerful developmental energy that lies in the deep unconscious. The Hindus say that it resides in the base of the spine, and that's another way of talking about that. They say that in most people, it's a latent energy or a dormant energy. It means it's not awakened. And yet when it is awakened, it produces some profound changes in the whole person. And finally, we say that this is an energy related to consciousness. It is the energy dimension of consciousness. For the Hindus, consciousness has two dimensions, which they talk about as Shiva and Shakti. Shiva is what we might call pure observation, the ability of consciousness to observe, to see. And Shakti is the energy that is observed. And in the highest states of consciousness, you have pure observation and pure energy. And you have Shiva and Shakti coming together. This is the way they talk about that. And of course, for them, sometimes this is not just a symbolic language. They really do believe that Shiva is a reality, not just a mythical or symbolic reality, and they know that Shakti is real too. Now, let's do something here. Let's not invoke Shiva. I'm not going to do that, but let's make a few observations about human consciousness and see if we can at least work that in this section. Consciousness is something that is perhaps taken for granted. It's one of the most unique things about a human being is that we have an awake consciousness, a self-consciousness. I'd like you to just simply notice the fact of your awareness or attention, the fact that you can pay attention. You might call it seeing, that there is a seeing that is always going on when you are awake. And in our dreams, it goes on even in our dreams. So when Father DeMello talks about seeing and awareness, this observation. Just notice it. Okay? Now notice how something focuses this attention. This attention is not generally open and cosmic, hearing everything equally and seeing everything equally. It's usually focused, that our awareness, our attention, is focused upon something and is tuning out other things. This focusing of attention is what we call intention. Oh, this one doesn't work. And I'm willing to say that you almost never find attention without finding intention. that the two go together. You can't separate them. That awareness always has a kind of intentionality with it, or a kind of a will that goes with it. And this intention focuses our awareness or our observation. And it usually focuses it in the direction of something we think we need or we want. Okay? So if I'm hungry and I'm riding around town, what will I notice? I'll notice places where I can eat. There might be beautiful flower beds on both sides of the road and other things like that, but my need works on my intentionality or will and focuses my intention, attention. If I have just had a hailstorm, as we had recently in Wichita, and the roof has been destroyed on the house, I'll ride around and I'll be looking at other roofs to see what's happened there. I'll be looking for roofers as well. There was one point in my life when I wanted to build a little shed behind my house. And I dare say I had gone 33 years of my life without noticing how many people have little sheds behind their houses and what they look like. But everywhere I drove for a few months, I was looking at houses to see what kind of little sheds they have and wondering how much those things cost. Okay? So we have this relationship between intention or need and want and attention. You might say that intention focuses attention in the same way that a hand directs a flashlight. You'd say the flashlight is observation, is the light of consciousness, is attention, is the seeing. But the seeing is always directed in some manner. It's directed towards something, and the hand that directs it is intention or will. Notice how the contents of consciousness affect intention and awareness and so forth, as we said here. The kinds of thoughts that we hold on to, the kinds of feelings or images we hold on to, affect our intention, which affects our attention. So when I use the word consciousness here, I'm talking about several things. Consciousness is attention plus intention. The two go together, we said. Plus the contents of consciousness, plus the energy. So consciousness is all of that. It's my awareness, and it's what's in my awareness, and it's where my awareness is focused and what is directed toward. And consciousness also includes the kind of energy that I'm experiencing in all of this. Does that make sense so far? That's what consciousness is. That's how I'm defining it for purposes of this workshop. Now, there is a center of consciousness, an awake center, and that's what we call the ego. The ego is the conscious aspect of consciousness, if you will, or the center of consciousness. And there's also an unconscious aspect of consciousness. So it'd be pretty common to draw the whole of consciousness as something like this, an ego and an unconscious. And this unconscious could include not just a bodily dimension, but a feeling dimension and spiritual as well. The unconscious is not just a basement. In other words, it's also an attic. All right. We're on the way now, right? So let's see. Intentionality is the motive of consciousness, the direction of the will. The contents of consciousness are the thoughts, feelings, memories, images, and so forth that influence the direction of the will. The thoughts that we have, the feelings we have, the memories that are in the field of consciousness all make some impact on our will or intention and influence it in a certain direction.